approximate
symmetry that's weakly broken. And if the vacua at early times and late times are misaligned, then this causes the field to oscillate. There's some energy in the field. And this can be your dark matter density, provided the oscillation doesn't start too early. The reason is that you have this energy density, and then it damps like the scale factor cubed. And so if you start it too early, then this stuff just redshifts away, and you don't have an appreciable number density of it. So typically, you need this oscillation scale to be sort of around the weak scale if you want to explain, say, the dark matter density. And just a minor correction to something that I did yesterday. So I wrote down this equation for the oscillation density. This just came from you have this particle in the potential, and energy is conserved. And so this is the energy density. But this is the energy density at the oscillation time. So if you're a little bit careful about the fact that the oscillation time, which for, say, an anomalous symmetry, starts when the coupling becomes non-perturbative, the coupling becomes big not just at the sort of place where it formally goes to infinity. It gets big a little bit before that. And so you can, in QCD, for instance, you can do a calculation with instantons where you explicitly get a form for, say, the effects of the anomaly a little bit above the phase transition. So this expression breaks down if you try to take the scale too high, but just a little bit above. And so you'll see that the oscillation time doesn't start exactly the phase transition. It starts a little bit before. And so this actually induces some F dependence. So if you go through all of the equations that I did yesterday, but you plug in this for the time at which oscillation starts, so this affects, say, the redshifting, just using all the results from then you get this almost linear dependence on the scale. So this was something that I was a little bit confused about yesterday, because in the equations I wrote down, it seemed like the amount of dark matter you got was independent of the parameter in your theory. But it actually, if you're very careful about the evolution of everything, there's some minor dependence. But the parametrics are the same. It's the same scales that I was talking about. All right, so we're going to change gears. We only have a few more lectures, so the next few lectures are kind of just going to be mostly motivational and explain some features of the other cosmological question that I raised in the first lecture, which was that we have sort of dark energy, and this wedge of the universe's total energy density. There's dark matter, and then there's baryons. And the omega baryons are about 5% of the total energy abundance. And this corresponds to a yield, which is the number density of baryons over S, of about 10 to the minus 10. Okay, and so dark matter, at least at this point, hopefully you've seen that there are lots of different ways that you can get dark matter, and they have different sorts of phenomenological implications. And so there are a lot of different ways of hunting for dark matter. So let's move on to this section, which is something that seems to be something we understand a lot better. Because baryons are just particles that are in the Standard Model. So what do we mean by baryons? So in the Standard Model, you can write down a U1 symmetry called the baryon number symmetry. And basically, all quarks have charge 1/3 under a baryon symmetry. Okay, and so Q bar have, you know, baryon number equal to -1/3. And if I write down all of my terms in my Lagrangian, I can see that it's invariant under this symmetry. Okay, and this is what we call an accidental symmetry, because this isn't something that I'm requiring my theory to have. It's just when I write down all possible gauge invariant operators, I automatically get this. And it basically comes from the fact that quarks are the only things that carry color charge, and so they always come in quark-antiquark pairs, and so my action is sort of automatically comes with this free baryon number symmetry. Okay. So, right, so if I write, for instance, my quark action, it's sort of the form of Q bar, gamma mu, d mu Q, plus some Higgs, Q bar left, Q right. So you can see if I change all of my Qs by a phase, then this thing is just invariant under that. Okay, and the reason why it's charged 1/3 is that the actual physical things that we see at low energy are bound states of quarks. Okay, so we see mostly protons and neutrons, and these consist of 3 quarks each. This is UUD and UDD. So each of these have Vera number 1. Okay. And Vera number as a symmetry was actually discovered before QCD, because we just found that, you know, all interactions seem to respect this baryon number. And it was only sort of once we had the full theory that we could explain it in terms of an accidental symmetry. So when I say baryons, I really just mean quarks, but this is the language that we have. And what's interesting about baryons is that we have only baryons cosmologically and not antibaryons. This is in spite of the fact that the standard model appears to conserve baryon number. Okay, so this is sort of a weird thing, because you have interactions that conserve baryon number, but we only seem to observe baryons and not antibaryons. So what this means is that my total baryon number, which is basically 3 times the number of quarks minus the number of antiquarks, is not equal to 0. Yes?
So the fact that we assign baryon number 1 for quarks is kind of related to the fact that we decided to assign protons and neutron baryon number 1.
That's right.
Because usually with E1 symmetry, it's the prefactor in the phase that is the charge, right?
So that's right.
According to the quark Lagrangian, that could have been any assignment, right?
Yeah, so for a U1 symmetry, you can basically assign any charge you want, and then I can just change what my definition of the U1 symmetry is. So I could just as easily have defined a U1 quark symmetry, and then everything would have charge 1, and the baryons would, or the, you know, P and N would have charge 3. But none of the physics changes. All I'm doing is I'm changing, you know, e to the I theta goes to e to the I alpha over 3. But, you know, this just defines some relative number for the transformations I'm doing. Okay, so this doesn't necessarily seem to be a problem, except that in most cosmological models, we have inflation. And inflation typically sort of resets the universe in some sense. The reason is that there's this huge exponential expansion which dilutes away everything, and then it decays and reheats the universe. So unless something weird is going on with the decays of the inflaton, which is a possibility, so I don't want to completely rule that out, but the inflaton is a real scalar field, so you don't necessarily expect it to violate these kinds of global symmetries. Then inflation usually gives B total equals 0 at T reheat. So basically, when I'm counting the beginning of the universe from the perspective of my thermal bath, I start with no net numbers of baryons, usually. So what we're interested in understanding is a process called baryogenesis. And what baryogenesis is it's a physical process that allows the evolution of the universe to go from a zero baryon number universe to a non-zero baryon number universe. Okay. So it's essentially physics involving standard model particles, but changing the net charges of the various fields. Okay. And so this gives rise to a very separate set of challenges from what we had in dark matter. In dark matter, the whole point was we were trying to find a particle with the right particle properties, whereas here we know what the kind of particles that are involved are, at least the standard model ones, and we want to figure out just how they evolve and how their evolution works. Okay, so the goal for today is, first of all, I'll provide some evidence for a baryon asymmetry, because there are a few possible objections that you could have for, you know, maybe the universe is actually baryon asymmetric, but it's just baryon asymmetric in a weird way, so that we haven't observed it yet. And then I'll describe some conditions, which are called the Sakharov conditions for baryogenesis. And these were identified by Andrei Sakharov, who's a famous Russian physicist in addition to a famous Russian dissident. And he came up with sort of the necessary conditions in order to have this evolution take place. So then what you can do is, once you understand this, you can take any model and say, does it satisfy the conditions? And then if it doesn't, then you can just write it off. It doesn't have anything to do with baryogenesis. And then if it does, you can ask what's the relative size of the asymmetry that you get out of it. And what we want is this is basically an NB minus NB bar over S. We want an asymmetry that's about this size. Okay? So this is a pretty small number relative to the thermal bath, but we'll see that moving from a state where you have no net charge to a state where you do have net charge, it sort of violates some of the thermodynamic things that like to happen in the early universe. And so it's actually hard to get a number that's this big sometimes. Okay, so are there any questions about why we want to do this or what I've said so far? Okay. So let's start with evidence. So the first bit of evidence is just kind of obvious, which is, you know, we exist. So if we look around us, when I step somewhere, I don't worry about hitting a pocket of antimatter and exploding. So we only, in our day-to-day lives, observe matter and not antimatter. And so this is already a problem from the perspective of a baryon symmetric universe. Okay. And this is also true astrophysically. So if we look at, say, point a cosmic ray telescope at the sky and count, say, the flux of protons versus antiprotons, we'll see that we see very, very few antiprotons and positrons relative to the protons in the universe. And all of the antimatter that we see can be explained in terms of secondary production. So basically, matter particles that strike other things and pair produce matter and antimatter. Okay, so we do see something, but it's consistent with there not being any cosmological abundance of antimatter at all. And in fact, looking for antimatter, as we discussed, is a good probe of dark matter annihilation, because dark matter annihilation tends to give you antimatter, whereas we just don't see any in the universe. And this becomes more and more true as you move to more complex things. So there are very few antiprotons, or even fewer antideuterons, and so we really don't see any evidence for antimatter in this. Okay? So you can ask, well, maybe we're just in a domain of matter. And so there's just sort of this local region that's baryon dominated. And the response to this is there's just no evidence for, say, sort of large scale PP bar annihilation astrophysically. So we can see quite far into the past and quite far out with our telescopes. And we don't seem to see any regions where they're sort of where these domains would touch each other, you would have a large amount of annihilation. And we certainly see a lot of interesting dynamics. Like in the first lecture, we talked about the bullet cluster. Yes, here. So that's sort of the next step. Yeah. So that's a trickier thing to explain, but we can at least convince ourselves that the domains are probably not that much smaller than a Hubble volume. So I mean, you can put some limit that's sort of on the order of like a few hundred megaparsecs or gigaparsec or something. But so basically, this can't be right. So then you could just have the possibility that Kieran mentions, which are that domains are larger than basically the Hubble length. And the problem with this is that even the current Hubble patch comes from many originally causally disconnected regions. So this was one of the original motivator, or you know, really the prime motivator of inflation, which is that the universe looks homogeneous and isotropic. But if you kind of scale back the evolution of the universe, various parts of the universe weren't ever talking to each other. So why is it that they're the same temperature? So inflation resolves this by saying, well, you started off with everything in causal contact and then you blew it up so that we're only seeing one originally causally connected region. So maybe that works out for here, but if we invoke inflation as an answer, this also gives you, so if inflation solves this problem and explains why we're only zoomed in on one patch, it also dilutes the NB over S that came before inflation. So we don't really expect there to be any baryons left. So even if there sort of were these domains of baryons and antibaryons, and then we sort of blew it up, they're so diluted that we would not expect to see the amount that we have. So this is a possibility. For instance, you could have two phases of accelerated expansion where you kind of you don't really reheat after the second one, and you just kind of zoom in on one particular thing. So these things are possible, but you have to have some weird cosmological things going on. And so from a particle physics perspective, since we can get this process happening in a particle physics theory, and indeed this process happens to a small extent in the standard model as well, it seems more plausible that this is what actually happened. But we, just like with dark matter, that there are possible astrophysical, you know, maybe gravity is modified, you can do similar things with baryogenesis and say, well, yeah, Tuber.
Kind of a historical question. Presumably Sakharov did it before the 1980s?
Yes.
And before inflation? So what was his original motivation?
So he actually believed that there were two domains, and so they were kind of in separate universes. So the Big Bang sort of created two universes. And so he was sort of operating in some weird mixture of different frameworks. And then the final bit of evidence is something that you calculated in tutorial, or that you maybe saw in your tutorial, which is thermal freeze-out. So this is sort of a cosmological scale piece of evidence, but there's annihilation between baryons and antibaryons. So for instance, PP bar can annihilate the pairs of pions. And in tutorial, you estimated, or maybe you estimated, the annihilation cross-section, and you end up with an enormous annihilation cross-section, because this is the strong interaction, so all the couplings are borderline non-perturbative, and so you typically end up with omega b that's about 10 to the minus 12 from this, just from thermal freeze-out. So if you imagine that it was baryon symmetric and baryons are a thermal relic, you just end up with way too few of them. And this is not something you can solve by expanding or diluting. So what this is telling you is that something kicks in at T of about 35 GeV to stop the thermal freeze-out process. But this is a very low scale for particle physics. It's around the time of BBN. You don't really want to mess up too much. So this provides a piece of evidence that something at higher temperatures came in to stop this annihilation. And a baryon-antibaryon isomerism will do exactly that, because if I just run out of P bars and I'm only left with Ps, then this annihilation shuts off. Okay. So just like dark matter, we have several different pieces of evidence that maybe each on their own is not totally convincing, but they combine to tell a story. Yes.
We would have frozen out protons.
We would have, so the amount of protons we would have left would be about 10 orders of magnitude. So omega b is about 10 to the minus 2. And the amount of baryons that would be left if it were just a thermal relic is about 10 to the minus 12. So you end up with too few protons as a thermal relic. But these same interactions are playing a role, say, in Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So you can't just be like, oh, there's something funny going on with this particular reaction, because that's not consistent with anything else in your cosmology. So there has to be some reason why something is going on with this. Okay. So you know, maybe you have some extremely low reheat temperature for the universe or something, and so maybe you can play some games to make this work. But like I said, all the pieces seem to point towards the fact that, you know, the simplest answer is just that there was an excess of baryons over antibaryons, and then all of this stuff just naturally comes out. Okay, so are there any other questions or possible objections? Because people are going to come up with creative things that, you know, we haven't thought of in terms of evidence for these things. Okay, so let's talk about the conditions for baryogenesis. So if we want to have this realized in a physical process, what is it that the physics has to do? And there are three of them. So the first one is that we need a violation of the U1 baryon number. So this is just a simple fact that if your symmetry is actually conserved, then you have a conserved charge through your entire evolution. And so you can't possibly go from a B equals zero to a B not equals zero universe. So this symmetry has to be broken in some way. The second thing that we need is something called CP violation. And CP is a symmetry, or I should say CP transformation, maps particles to antiparticles. And when I go through these in more detail, we'll explore exactly what this means. But the basic idea is that even if I violate baryon number, I need there to be something that tells me I should accumulate more baryons rather than more antibaryons. Because if I'm always producing them together, then you know I can violate baryon number, but I'll always end up with the same number of particles and antiparticles, and you never actually end up with an effective net baryon number. So basically just that nature has to pick out one of the two in order to have more of it. And so if nature exactly respects the symmetry between particles and antiparticles, then you can't get any asymmetry between them. Okay, and then the third thing is a departure from thermal equilibrium. And the very short version of this condition is just that if you're in thermal equilibrium, all forward and reverse rates are happening at the same time. So basically, all the total time derivative of anti-quantity is sort of by equal to zero by definition in equilibrium. In equilibrium, nothing's changing in time, and so I can't possibly change the total number of baryons versus number of antibaryons. Okay, so this has been a little bit heuristic, so maybe we'll explore these all in a little bit more detail. So we'll start with baryon number violation. So as we already said, that if the U1B is an exactly conserved symmetry, then this is just equal to a constant. And this follows from, yes, Kieran.
So whenever we're talking about this stuff, we're always talking about baryogenesis and the baryon asymmetry. Is there a lepton asymmetry? And should we worry about that as well?
So we don't actually know. Okay, I shouldn't say that. I can't say that. We don't know that there's a lepton asymmetry.
Okay. We certainly see more electrons than positrons, but what we don't see are neutrinos. So it's possible that there are like a huge number of antineutrinos, and you know they're neutral, and it's hard to distinguish neutrinos from antineutrinos. So we're not guaranteed that there's a lepton asymmetry. The fact that there are equal numbers of, say, electrons and protons is guaranteed by electric charge conservation. Okay, so that's an exact gauge symmetry, and that's conserved. So we're always going to have alignment of those charges. But we can't say what goes on with neutrinos. So for instance, the bound on the neutrino asymmetry is about 10 to the minus 2, which is 8 orders of magnitude larger than the baryon asymmetry. And it could be 0, it could be negative. We don't really know. So, but it turns out that a lepton asymmetry can play a crucial role in generating baryon asymmetry, so the two are linked together, as we'll discuss probably tomorrow. Okay, so if this symmetry is exactly preserved, then we have our usual, there's a conserved current, and you can integrate the current to give you a charge, and that charge is just the total baryon number. So this is a constant if U1B is exact. So what we need are processes that are like, I'll draw my sort of super sketchy Feynman diagram where I start out with some state that's zero baryon number and evolve it into a state with one baryon number, say, or n baryon number. So, and again, if my symmetry is conserved, this term just doesn't show up anywhere in my action. Now, one thing that's worth pointing out is that as we saw when we were talking about pseudoscalars, symmetries can be a little bit tricky because the actual symmetries, whether they're conserved or not, depends on all of the interactions in your theory and all of the particles in your theory. So this could explain how U1 baryon number is broken in the standard model. Maybe there are some particles that are heavy that break it and we just don't know about them yet. So, in some sense, this is the easiest condition that we can see we need to satisfy. The second is CP violation. In some ways, this has the most subtleties in it. So I want to spend a bit of time on it. So CP takes particles and antiparticles and maps them into one another. Okay, now this C is what's usually called the charge conjugation symmetry. And this is typically called parity symmetry. So this is an inversion of the spatial coordinates. And this is taking all of your charges and flipping them. Now, one of the confusing aspects is, why is it that it's CP that relates particles and antiparticles and not C, which is a charge conjugation? And the reason for this is, if we consider a two-component fermion, so a Weyl fermion, the field is some fermion, which is labeled by some index, and the antiparticle is given by complex conjugation. And complex conjugation actually turns this, say, a left-handed spinner into a right-handed spinner. Okay. So we see that moving from, so it changes a left-handed spinner into a right-handed spinner. And if we look at the charge assignment associated with this, this is going to be some e to the I theta. This is going to be an e to the minus I theta, because I've taken the complex conjugate. So we see that an antiparticle flips the sign of the charge, and it also flips parity. So it takes a left-handed fermion and maps it into a right-handed fermion, and vice versa. Okay. So the individual charge conjugation and parity symmetries only apply if you have Dirac fermions, where you actually have combinations of two different Weyl fermions. But it sort of maps the different Weyl fermions into one another. So if you want some symmetry that just takes a particle into its antiparticle, it's always the combination CP that does this. So if I want to create more baryons than antibaryons, I need to have basically processes that produce more psis than psi daggers. Okay? Or I want to destroy more psi daggers than psis. Yes, Tibor. Yeah.
It's kind of automatic.
Well, so for
Dirac, you have to add in that there's both a C violation and a CP violation. Okay. Really, for baryogenesis, it's the CP violation that's the really crucial part. Okay. And in the standard model, everything is made up of Weyl fermions at high energy, right? Because we have a chiral theory, so the weak interactions only couple to the left-handed instead of the right-handed. So we really need to think of it in this picture. Okay. Right.
My understanding of like a Weyl fermion versus a Dirac fermion is just your choice of basis, basically, that you want to write.
No, so
a Dirac fermion actually consists of two Weyl fermions.
Yeah, they're like stacked one on top of each other.
Right. So
the point is that charge conjugation will change, say, psi into chi, and P will change psi into chi dagger, and the combination of CP will change psi into psi dagger. This is how the actions go on the Weyl fermions inside of a Dirac fermion.
Right, but why did you say you needed an additional violation if you're going to write them as to me, you could write a theory entirely in terms of Weyl fermions or entirely in terms of Dirac fermions. It would just be a lot messier in one particular case.
Yeah, I mean, I think generally if you break CP, you're also going to break this C symmetry. But you could imagine if you break C and parity in such a way that you conserve CP, but C is broken. So, anyway, CP is the really important thing that you need to break. Okay, so what breaking CP means, just to put it on the board, is that we want to have, say, the production cross-section of psi not equal to the production cross-section of psi dagger. All right, so how do we actually get CP violation in a theory? So what are the parameters that control this? So we see that CP violation, the CP, which is particle versus antiparticle, is related to Hermitian conjugation of our fields. So what this tells us is that we need complex parameters in our Lagrangian. Hey, because if I write out my Feynman rules, all of the processes that involve psi dagger, so processes in, you know, Feynman rules, are just the complex conjugate of the Feynman rules for psi. And this just follows from the fact that the Lagrangian has to be Hermitian, it's self-conjugate. Okay, so if I have a term that has a psi, I have to add a psi dagger term that's a complex conjugate to make it real. Okay, so basically the story is that I need to have complex phases showing up in my Lagrangian. So basically anywhere I can, you know, masses, couplings, all of these things in the standard model, they can actually be complex numbers. And if they're complex numbers, then when I take these two rates, they're conjugates of one another, they're not necessarily going to be the same. Now it's a bit more subtle than this. And the reason is that if I write down a Lagrangian, I write down a Lagrangian in a particular basis, while the actual like physical processes are basis independent. So what this means is that I can write down a Lagrangian that's loaded with complex phases, but if it turns out that I can get rid of all of those phases by just redefining all of my fields so that I could, in principle, have also written it with just real parameters, then when I calculate any physical quantity, I'm not going to end up with any CP violation. Okay. So I need to ensure that there is no possible basis in which I can write the Lagrangian such that there are no complex phases. And this is generally a tricky thing to do because there are lots of possible field redefinitions that you can do. Okay, so as an example, I'll just show a scalar field, complex scalar field. Okay, and this scalar field isn't charged under any global symmetry, so I'll just write, say, V of phi, I'll write a few terms, there'll be m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth plus, say, g phi to the fourth plus Hermitian conjugate. Now, this term is real. The phi squared is self-conjugate, so that tells me that my mass is real. Okay, because I'm not adding anything else to it, and so, I mean, I could write it as a complex number, but then when I take the Hermitian conjugate, I get m squared plus m star squared, which is a real number. Okay, so basically any coefficient of a real term, so like psi bar psi or you know, phi squared, these things that are self-conjugate, there's no phase in these. So what this leaves is the possibility in this potential that I have some, you know, g is a complex number. Okay. So in the most general case, g is basically g times e to the, what's a good letter to use? I theta. Okay, so I say, oh, great. I have this potential. It has a complex number in it, so this violates CP. But it's not quite so easy because I can redefine my field phi by taking phi to e to the minus I theta over 4 phi. And then when I write out my potential, I get, you know, real terms plus absolute value of g phi to the fourth. So I started with a potential that had a complex number in it, but just by changing the, you know, this shows up as in a path integral, and I can change the variables in the path integral, there's nothing wrong with that. I end up with, this is purely real. So we have to conclude that even though I wrote something with a complex number in it, this particular potential does not lead to any physical CP violation. Now, if I were to add, say, another term that looks like this, so for instance, if I take v of phi as m squared phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth plus g phi to the fourth plus, say, mu phi squared, I now have two complex parameters, namely g and mu, but I only have one possible field redefinition. So for instance, if I take this transformation to get rid of the g phase, this term turns into, say, mu e to the I alpha e to the minus I theta over 2 times phi squared. And then if I try to rotate this phase, I push it back into this other coupling. Okay. So I see that, in this scenario, there is a physical phase. And the physical phase is basically alpha minus theta over 2. OK, so what this shows us is that we're generally going to need to have complex parameters in Lagrange, but we have to be a little bit careful with how we parameterize them. And in particular, a sort of heuristic way you can understand when CP violation shows up in a process or not is, in order to be sensitive to this phase, the process has to talk to both of these couplings. Okay? So I sort of have to involve both the phi to the fourth and the phi squared in my interaction. Because if I only involve one of them, I can pick a basis where I rotate the phase away and it's purely real. Yes, Rob.
So does it even make sense to talk about a complex scalar given that there's no global Fermi number for this scalar because we're putting in explicit squared phi terms?
I mean, you can talk about it. So for instance, in supersymmetric theories, you can have a chiral superfield that is not charged under anything, but it's definitely a complex scalar. Okay. What this is secretly telling you is that there's some sort of so you can certainly decompose this into two real scalar fields. It makes your notation bulkier. Okay.
Where do I have the CP violation if I have two real scalar fields? Or don't I just have
risk? Well, so the difference is that one of the fields is a scalar and the other is a pseudo-scalar, and so you have to have factors of I to
show up in it. Because the way you have to expand phi is equal to phi 1 plus I phi 2. So you get complex. So the couplings are complex and they cancel with some of the I's here. So it's more subtle. So it's easier to just write it like this. But you do end up with CP violation with something like this. Okay, so now we'll just assume we have some CP violating phases. I'm going to move away from this example and try to be a bit more general. How does this translate to a difference in rate? So how does this give, for example, sigma psi minus sigma psi dagger not equal to 0? And part of why this is confusing is that we know that sigma is the absolute value squared of a matrix element. Okay, so this is something that's real. And so we're sort of asking, well, how is it that complex numbers in my fundamental theory propagate through? Okay, and obviously, because we're talking about CP violation, it can happen. But it happens in a sort of non-trivial way. So what I'll do is I'll define two matrix elements. I'll define a matrix element for producing a psi, say. I'm going to try to keep it as general as possible, so it's a little bit schematic. But for instance, you could imagine something where you have like scalar to psi psi. Okay. And then we're going to define the matrix element of the process of psi dagger production, which would be scalar dagger to psi dagger psi dagger. But the important thing is that these two processes are the same, except they are CP conjugates of one another. Okay. And so we're first going to make the conjecture that n is equal to m tilde star. So this seems reasonable. These things are CP conjugate processes. And this transformation of CP is complex conjugation. And so we're going to make this assumption and see what happens to the rates. Okay. So this means I can, you know, there's some phase, so I can define n as some real number times a phase. Okay, so now we'll go order by order in perturbation theory. Okay, so let's say we have a single process. M squared is just I just take the absolute value squared of this phase, and it gives me something that's real. Okay, it gives me M1 squared. If I take M tilde squared, this is just M1 e to the minus I phi squared. This is just M1 squared. So we see that the matrix element for the regular process and the CP conjugate process are the same. So this tells me that C psi is equal to C psi dagger if I'm only considering a single matrix element. So, and this is just a simple observation that we take the absolute value squared of the matrix element. So it doesn't matter how many complex phases I have in my matrix element. If there's only one of them and I square it, the phase goes away. So this gives us lesson number one. We basically need to have two terms in the matrix element. Because if we only have one term, then when I take the absolute value squared, I don't get any CP violation. So this is bad. Okay, so I can write down what happens if I have two matrix elements. So there generally will be two terms here. There are going to be two phases here. And generally in perturbation theory, there's sort of an infinite number of these, but I'll just stop at two because that's all we really need to have a difference in rates. Okay. So if I take the absolute value of this square, yes, Tibra. Okay, you're right. If I'm summing over all, so what this is telling me is I need to at least go to second order in perturbation theory. But if I'm being really careful, I can compute higher order corrections. Okay. But if I think about this as a perturbative expansion, M1 is much bigger than M2.
But could it not be that even at the same order as the previous M's, you have two dagger?
Yeah, you can have that as well. Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a higher order process, but you need to have at least two. And if I only have one coupling, then it's going to be in a perturbative expansion. Yeah. But the key thing is I need to have two terms. That's non-negotiable. Okay, so if I take the absolute value squared, I'm going to end up with some real number squared plus some other real number squared plus two times the real part of this. Okay. And so this is going to give me something that's real, or sorry, that's phi independent plus a term that goes like 2m1, m2. Cos phi 1 minus phi 2. Okay? So great, I now have my CP violating phases have shown up in my matrix element squared, which is then going to show up in a rate. Yes? Pardon me? So because it's the absolute value squared, I take the Hermitian conjugate of one of these. So what this is telling you is that if my phases are the same, then it's just an overall phase. It doesn't show up anywhere. Okay. Okay, so now I can do the same thing for m tilde squared, assuming that m1 and m2 are real. Okay. So basically, my m, I'll just write it out explicitly. My m tilde is m1 e to the minus I phi 1 plus m2 e to the minus I phi 2. And when I compute m tilde squared, I get m1 squared plus m2 squared plus 2m1 m2 cos phi 1 minus phi 2. Okay, so we have the CPU phases show up, but we still have the physical process of psi production versus psi dagger production is the same. So once again, sigma psi is equal to sigma psi dagger. There's no CP violation. Okay, so this tells us that this conjecture is wrong. I cannot have that n and m tilde are just complex conjugates of one another. Because if I do that, then I end up with something that's just a real number, I end up with the same real number, and when I subtract them, I end up with zero for the difference in the rates. So what we actually need is, so we need n, you know, psi production is not equal to m tilde, which is, you know, psi dagger production conjugate. So how is this in any way consistent? Because we already said that the Feynman diagrams of these things are exactly the same, except they're the complex conjugates of one another. And it turns out that the answer is that it's true, all of the couplings and things in the Feynman diagram, so couplings and et cetera in Feynman diagram are complex conjugates. But there has to be an extra phase that is the same for m and m tilde. Okay. So what does that mean? So one thing I can do to just simplify the calculation a little bit is I notice that the only thing that it's really important is this phi 1 minus phi 2. So I can actually make one of these things real and shunt all of my phases into just one of the terms. What this means is that my matrix element has to have the form real number e to the I phi 1 plus I theta 1. And m tilde has to have the form m1 e to the minus I phi 1 plus I theta 1 plus m2. Okay, so these things are not complex conjugates of one another. This phase is complex conjugated, and this phase is not complex conjugated. And if you actually write this out, you'll see that sigma psi minus sigma psi dagger gives you something that's minus 2 m1 m2 sine theta 1 sine phi 1. Okay, basically, it comes from the fact that you have these two phases, but they show up differently in the m and the m tilde. Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry. Sorry, the presets seem to be broken on these boards at the moment. So. Yeah. So what you need are, we call this a CP odd phase, which is a phase that is different. They're complex conjugates between the CP, you know, the sine psi dagger process. And we have this, what's called a CP even phase. I'll just write that in. This is CP even, CP odd. Okay. So all of the couplings are CP odd phases. Because if I have a Feynman rule that's like, you know, psi, like this is in Weyl fermion notation, if this coupling gives me some I lambda, then, well, that's for I times the matrix element. The complex conjugate of the process gives me a lambda star. Okay. So CP transformations conjugate the coupling. And that's just what we already saw. So where does the CP even phase come from? And the answer to this is quantum mechanics in a sort of gross sense. Okay. So all of these couplings are classical things, right? This is a classical field theory that I've defined. But I know that quantum mechanics gives me factors of I. So for instance, in the Schrodinger equation, I have something that's like, you know, ddt of psi is equal to minus ih psi. So we see that quantum evolution can give you extra factors of I. And the quantum mechanical factors of I don't care about whether you're a particle or an antiparticle. Okay, so let's look at an example. So we'll use this example, which is the time evolution operator. So I'll consider a relativistic particle with mass m and momentum p. We'll call it psi. Then I can just write down the time evolution. This is just e to the minus I p squared plus m squared t over psi. Okay, so hopefully this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone. Now let me write down the same thing for psi bar. Well, the energy, so the mass of the psi bar has to be the same as the mass of the psi. This is guaranteed by the CPT conservation. Okay, the physical masses are of a particle and antiparticle are the same. So I end up with exactly the same phase factor . So what we need is, so for instance, there are processes where you have sort of things that are, you know, point-like interactions followed by some coherent propagation. This introduces a CP even phase into your matrix element, okay? Because if I compute the time evolution or propagation, say, of psi versus psi bar, these things have to be the same. And so this can give rise to exactly this kind of structure in your matrix element.
I guess this is a picture independent statement, right?
It's the same about the CP.
No, I was just wondering, in the Heisenberg picture, this would show up. How would?
Well, then you're just transforming your operators, but the operators transform under the same phase. Yeah. So this is a picture independent statement. I mean, you're probably not going to actually stitch this into your. Well, actually, that's not true. There's some methods of baryogenesis where precisely this phase shows up. But I'm just showing this to illustrate that you should be used to CP even phases. There are just some phases that show up in quantum mechanics, and they're related to the energy of the system. And the energy of the system does not care whether you are a psi or a psi bar. Okay. So in QFT, we can look at propagators. And if you look, for instance, at Peskin chapter 7, I won't explicitly derive this, but the imaginary part of the propagator of some particle, say phi, I'll just call it, is basically equal to m phi times gamma phi when this is evaluated at p equals to m phi. And you can see this explicitly if you calculate loop corrections to the propagator. And so let's say that there are some intermediate particles that run through here. When I compute these loop corrections, I end up with sort of logs. So they're log divergences. I end up with logs of various things. And it turns out that if m phi is bigger than 2 m psi, these particles can actually go on shell in the loop, and this generates an imaginary part of the phi propagator, which is exactly equal to m times its width. So this is the like width as you compute in, you know, QFT1. And this is something that you used on your first problem set, the fact that the Higgs had this width and that produced an imaginary part of the propagator. It's the exact same thing. And this also doesn't care if it's a particle or an antiparticle. So if I have in my Feynman diagram a loop, and the particles in this loop can go on shell, this gives me an imaginary part for my matrix element that's independent of whether it's a particle or an antiparticle. And it's precisely the same thing. It's because this imaginary part is related to a width, and this is just a physical energy property. It's sort of an imaginary part of the energy. And this is the same for particles versus antiparticles. Okay. So all of this is just to argue that it's not totally crazy to expect these CP even phases to pop up, but they have to come through something. So what this tells you is, if I summarize what I need, oh, I'm already in this corner. Okay. Erase this. So I need for CP violation the interference of two terms, and I need a CP even phase. So canonically, in processes that give you CP violation, you can combine the two things with the fact that there is an imaginary part of this loop to see that what you want is some tree-level process, which gives you psi, plus some loop process, which gives you psi. And then when I compute the interference of this thing, this gives rise to CP violation. Okay, sort of bundling it all together. So this is sort of the canonical picture. Then I'm going to need interference between tree and loop processes. But you don't actually necessarily need this to be a loop. What I really need is it to be a CP even phase. And this can come from a loop. It can come from just your normal time evolution, et cetera. Okay. So CP violation is definitely the most non-trivial part of all of these conditions. And so tomorrow we'll finish talking about equilibrium. And that one is pretty quick to understand. And then what we'll do is we'll look and see, are these conditions satisfied in the standard model? So can we get a baryon versus anti-baryon asymmetry without adding in new physics?
Oh, right.
What would a tree level diagram that is has a CP even phase look like compared to one that has a CP odd phase? Because you can tell with the loop diagram, like, provided there's enough energy flowing through this, I'm going to get my imaginary part, and that'll make sense. But like, how would I find the basically Feynman diagrams that would fit that criteria?
So if you have processes with, say I have some three-body process where this is something decaying through a particle phi 1 and phi 2, then this propagator can look like 1 over p squared minus m phi squared plus I m phi gamma. So this is a CP even phase. This also has a CP even phase. So in principle, these things can be different. Okay, so you can end up with things coming from tree-level phases. Now, for this process, the width is usually small compared to other things, and so this gives you some practically negligible contribution. But if it's actually going on shell, you can have a large imaginary part in the matrix element.
And that's still all coming from just doing the
electron. Yeah, that's secretly a loop, isn't it?
It's, yeah.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, like,
It's secretly a, yeah.
So I was just wondering, basically, how does, like, you gave this argument about quantum mechanics, and I'm just wondering.
You definitely need quantum mechanics and stuff. So you can argue that
it comes from a loop. It can also come from this time evolution operator. So let's say I have some state that doesn't interact between two interactions. Like, I sort of produce a particle and it propagates and then it goes into something else. If this doesn't interact with anything, then it's just evolving under quantum mechanics while it's propagating. So you can still express it in this language and, in terms of the appropriate correlators, but just then the normal quantum mechanics phase pops out.
Okay, so are those two things secretly the same thing? like the quantum mechanical evolution and this imaginary.
No, because this is true even if I don't have an unstable particle set. And, you know, so secretly the I is coming from some kind of propagation. Okay, so it's either I have a loop process and these particles have a physical propagation that gives me a phase,
mm-hmm.
or I have a single particle that's propagating and that gives me a phase. But
it doesn't necessarily have to be a loop in that sense. It's just coming from some propagation properties. Okay.
The two diagrams have like different energy at some point, so that the propagation is kind of different.
What do you mean by the diagrams have different energy? Okay. Yeah, so that will, that's true, but if the energies are too different, then, so you can always talk about decomposing things into like the energy basis or the interaction basis. So I think if the energies are too different, then basically there's very little mixing between the states. And so then their interference, say, will be very small. So generally you need these things to have comparable energy behaviors. So, Kieran.
This is kind of going back to the electron asymmetry.
Is there, would it be possible for there to be an extra baryon that we don't know about that kind of mops up this baryon number?
Yes. So it depends on what you call baryon, but morally speaking, you're right. So when I say that there has to be a violation of baryon number symmetry, what I really mean is standard model baryon symmetry. So literally the symmetry under which standard model quarks are charged. So for instance, there's a theory that's called Dirac leptogenesis. So the idea is that you create a lepton asymmetry in left-handed leptons and an anti-lepton asymmetry in right-handed leptons so that the total global charge is zero. But these two sectors are kind of pushed apart so they don't talk to each other, okay? And that's totally fine because you're violating the standard model version of the symmetry, and it doesn't matter that there's some BSM particle that's picking up the extra charge. But yeah, that's a very good question, and that's how a lot of these things go. Yeah, you can get rid of it.